capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Hello and welcome to this Level Talk programme. My name is John Harrison. Let me start this programme by quoting Sun Tzu, the Chinese military strategist who wrote over 2,000 years ago, "Supreme excellence consists in breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting. Fighting the enemy indirectly allows an opponent to defeat their adversary without directly engaging them, thus saving resources. Attacking the enemy indirectly can also bog them down and put them on the defensive." Now, according to many international observers, warfare is becoming more hybrid as nations have at their disposal economic levers, informational tools, and new weapons that don't need to be fired from a nearby location. In fact, they can be controlled from a different continent. A hybrid war, some say, is being fought against Russia in the form of economic sanctions, negative press, and pressure on states surrounding Russia to join forces against Russia. Other people say Russia is fighting a hybrid war against countries in Europe. The US is accused of using hybrid war technology in the form of encouraging color revolutions in the Middle East. Now, how true is all this? Are we living in an age of hybrid warfare? I'm very honoured to be joined today in this discussion, in this programme, by Andrei Vitchik, a geopolitical analyst, novelist, filmmaker and investigative journalist, now in Hong Kong, and also Dr. James Corum, an American air power historian, scholar of counterinsurgency. He's written several books on counterinsurgency and other topics. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the 1st US Army and served in Iraq, and also served as editor of Baltic Security and Defence Review. Welcome both of you to this program today.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Now, what is hybrid warfare? I've read out my interpretation of it, but I'd very much like to hear your point of view, Dr. Corum, to begin with, please. What is hybrid warfare?
Well, hybrid warfare, as you started with Sun Tzu, is absolutely nothing new.
Yeah.
Some of the tactics and the technologies are new. The American Revolution included conventional war, terrorism, economic warfare, diplomacy, propaganda campaigns, all of the things that we're talking about. Conflict of the last century has included economic pressure, diplomacy. So I'm always cautious about buzzwords that come along as if this is something new.
Mm-hmm.
The Cold War was hybrid, I would call it conflict, but with proxy wars and propaganda and so forth. And as to whether the U.S. is doing this or not, I wish we would get better at it. I wish we would be conducting hybrid conflict. Unfortunately, people, and I'm writing a paper or a report for NATO right now saying that they need to get better at doing information operations, that they're terrible at it.
Okay. So that's a very interesting point of view, that this is nothing new, that has been going on since war began, and probably even before we thought of the word war. For, you know, we're running around half naked throwing stones at each other. I bet then we were scheming with others and spreading rumours. Andrei Vitchik, your point of view, please, on what on earth is this thing called hybrid warfare?
Well, I actually agree with Colonel, and I have been covering these hybrid wars all over the world. I recently published a book with 840 pages called Exposing Lies of the Empire, and I basically traveled to all corners of the world where the Western Empire is actually conducting these wars.
Mm-hmm.
I just returned to Asia from Latin America. I spent more than a month traveling in Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, where we have exactly what was described going on. There is a huge support for color revolution, so-called opposition movements, economical pressure, propaganda, and many different ways how to get rid of the unwanted or uncomfortable governments, progressive governments, left-wing governments in Latin America, and how to actually bring back the extreme right-wing and, neoliberal pro-Western regimes. We saw it happening in two different ways, one in Argentina in a softer way through elections, and in Brazil through what is often called as constitutional coup.
I want to argue against both of you then at the moment, because, in centuries gone by, we didn't have globalization of the economy. We didn't have such a thing as the IMF. We didn't have countries interlocked and engaged with each other on a financial sphere, whereby if you cut one section of the international community off from the others, they suffer because they were or they are part of a global network of transactions. Surely this changes the game, because in the 18th and 19th centuries, a country didn't have those kinds of weapons at their disposal.
Well, again, people have more sophisticated techniques. You go back a century, and the stock market crash in New York affected the entire world. The fall of the Kreditenanstalt in Europe caused a chain reaction across Europe of bank failures. The world has been a lot more connected for a lot longer than you think. Mm-hmm. I would argue the First World War was the Seven Years' War. Again, to a degree, we're noticing globalization, but so many ways, it's just another buzzword. The fundamental basics of international relations are still there. I've been reading nonsense for decades about how corporations would take over states and so forth. And again, a lot of it is just overdone. I'm a historian. I see the big picture.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, the First World War is not long ago, really,
It was a century ago, yes.
It's a century ago, which isn't that long ago in the terms of the history of war, surely.
Okay, well, the point being is that the one thing that has changed is communications is relatively instantaneous.
Yeah.
The use of the internet is certainly new in that place. Capital always flowed across borders. It has ever since the Dutch invented the stock market in the 1600s. But today, it's the one thing that is relatively new is the speed which information flows and information operations, which is why the study I'm doing for NATO right now is about information and disinformation and so forth, because the technologies have transformed this part. The other parts, I don't think, have been so fundamentally transformed.
Fair enough. Andre, in your experiences in South America, do you see information now as being a sort of the major tool in the new 21st century weapon box?
Oh, definitely. If you see what is happening right now from Venezuela to Ecuador to Brazil to Argentina, basically the U.S. is and the West in general is using information as a tool, very powerful tool actually, to push its agenda in the entire region, the entire world. So we talk about these governments, left-wing governments, let's say in Venezuela or in Ecuador, but if you work in Ecuador, you realize that although part of Telesur, part of the very important television network, which is based in Caracas, Venezuela, part of it is based also in Ecuador. This is supposed to be this powerful propaganda tool of the socialist countries against the Western propaganda. But you will also realize that wherever you fly, wherever you hotel you stay in Ecuador, mostly you see CNN in Spanish. You have all the cable television stations that are being beamed to the day and night all over Latin America. It's because distribution of the channels are still in private hands, and they are mostly belong to the big companies, to rich families, and they actually are censoring the left-wing information, left-wing channels. You cannot listen to RT in South America in English. Mm-hmm. And even in Spanish, there is a limited access to the channels, to the left-wing channels, even in the socialist countries.
Dr. Quorum, I think that you probably agree that information is a very powerful thing, and you started off the program by saying that Americans should get better at it.
So, first of all, journalistic colleague is talking about whether as if the United States had a clear agenda, and I would say under the last three presidents, we have not had anything in the sense of a clear foreign policy. you know, as to whether Venezuela, we can see that under Chavez Maduro, it turned into a full-scale dictatorship, right? And right now, they adopted socialism, they went progressive, they're starving. That's a self-inflicted wound. I've spent time in Latin America, and I can tell you the third world countries love to blame everyone else. The Argentinians used to be one of the richest people in the world. They adopted Peronism. They destroyed their own economy by going progressive. All of the countries, you know, I've lived for years in former republics of the Soviet Union, and they rejected all of that when they achieved their re-independence in 1991. Those countries are all now much richer than Russia because they went Western. If you want prosperity, you go Western. The reason Ukraine is poor is that they failed to completely throw out everything of the old system and go democracy and West. And that's why countries like Belarus and Ukraine are impoverished countries.
I think that now we're getting into a different area, and that's using information as disinformation. Because I, for example, live in Moscow some of the time, and the rest of the time I live in the UK, and I'm aware of the information that's been spread about Russia in the UK, and it's very much along the lines of what you just said. And in fact, in Moscow is completely different from the impression that people have living in the UK. And of course, there is some truth in all these things. There's always a little bit of truth to give it credibility, you know.
I'm going by the figures of the average GDP, per person GDP. Your Baltic states are all per person GDP. They were impoverished places 20-something years ago. Now, Estonia is about 20,000 per person, which is 7,000 above Russia. You know, all of the countries that went Western are all more prosperous, and they don't have the big oil resources. They had far fewer resources. It's democracy and capitalism that creates prosperity. Mm-hmm. It's progressivism, socialism that creates poverty. Simple as that.
Well, you know, I wish the world was simple like that, you know, because there's a completely different argument to it in regards to the Baltic republics. But let's switch over to Andre. Maybe he has something to say on this in this regard.
Well, I think what we hear right now is from Colonel is exactly the case of Western disinformation and propaganda. I just worked in November and December in Central Asian republics, and it's absolute nonsense. The standard of living is collapsing. I worked in Kyrgyzstan, where they kicked out the U.S. military base. 90%, more than 90% of people that I spoke to are dreaming about Soviet Union, and they would go there back if they would be taken, if there would be something like Soviet Union tomorrow. The same thing in Uzbekistan and even in Kazakhstan, which is doing economically much better than both Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. There is absolutely great nostalgia for the former system. There is not one country in Central Asia, not one, that would be welcoming the Western system. And about Latin America, the same thing. The socialism, actually, if it would be left alone in Venezuela or in Ecuador or elsewhere, it pulled out hundreds of thousands, millions of people out of poverty. It created totally new dynamics in the countries that were colonies. They were exploited, raped by the West. And if it wouldn't be for the direct intervention from the U.S. mostly in that part of the world, then we would have absolutely... The reason why people eat garbage now in Venezuela is because of this opposition, so-called opposition, fully subsidized and financed by the West.
I don't know how Central Asia got into this. I was talking about the European countries that had essentially European culture. The Central Asian countries are probably bound to be impoverished and wish for dictatorship. They have never known anything other than dictatorship and controlled economies, ever. That's their history. That's why that they're going to fail. It's a cultural issue. You go around the world and you see these cultural issues. In Argentina, there's an ancient saying in South America that never underestimate the stupidity of the Peronistas. In Latin America, various countries, the one country that's richest is Chile, and they're the one that are most democratic and capitalist.
Right, yeah, that's a very interesting, very American point of view. Thank you. Let's take a break here.
capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Welcome back to Level Talk Programme. My name's John Harrison. Today we're talking about hybrid warfare. And I'm joined by Andrei Vichik, geopolitical analyst, novelist, filmmaker, investor, journalist, and also Dr. James Corum, an American air power historian and scholar of counterinsurgency. We've been talking about the hybrid war in this program. We've been talking about the power of information, and as an example of two completely different points of view, we have two opposing sides on the subject of who's right and who's wrong in the present geopolitical game. So, Dr. Corum, are you saying that richness, wealth, depends on whether a country adopts Western democracy? Is that what you're saying?
To a large degree, yes. Take a look at Japan. South Korea, the time I was born, was war-devastated and impoverished. Look at it today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They evolved from relatively authoritarian into a full democracy. The countries that have done that, and again, South America, go to Chile. Take a look at the country that is the most capitalist, the most democratic, is also the richest and most prosperous.
Yes, I lived 5 years in Santiago de Chile, right after the pro-Western dictatorship collapsed. There were the greatest discrepancies between the disparities between the rich and poor in the entire Latin America. It's only under the socialist governments of Michelle Bachelet and Ricardo Lagos that things began changing.
And another way of looking at it is just a simple fact that not all countries want to be Western democracies. I mean, let's take China. I lived there in the 1970s and the 1980s, and the progress that country has made is absolutely incredible. I mean, it is unbelievable. I think a lot depends on a country's cultural roots, you know, whether there is a separation of state and nation, as there is in Western Europe, which America has basically inherited, or not. And I think to make a statement like that, that a country cannot be successful unless it adopts so-called Western democracy, is a wonderfully simplistic way of looking at the world, you know.
Well, again, okay, I'm dealing with the worldview. I'm talking simple economics here. I'm also talking, again, your cultural factors. China has certain cultural factors.
Yeah.
But, you know, ending Maoism, ending hardcore communism, enabled them, their economy, to grow. That's a simple fact. And what is the most prosperous part of China? It's Hong Kong, the one part of China where there is some amount of freedom. And then you contrast Taiwan with China. We can go on and on. And I've lived in Latin America as well. And I've traveled extensively there. I've been to Asia. I will take a country that has essential economic freedoms and freedom of the press over authoritarian states any day of the week. And I've lived in the Baltics that are under threat, open threat, from the post-Cold War Russian state.
Well, there's a couple of things here that sort of are fairly obvious for perhaps anybody who's looking at it from a different perspective. Firstly, where would the Baltics be without the EU support? Estonian IT business is fantastic. Latvia and Latvia's economy is in not such good condition. The whole issue of Russia invading the Baltic states, well, if Russia was intending to do that, why hasn't it done it already? You know, and sort of there's an awful lot of misinformation about this being generated, including very high rates of unemployment in the Baltic republics and so on, so on, so on. Andrei.
Again, when we talk about Western democracy, what are we talking about? We are talking about what George Orwell called people and unpeople. I mean, people are the core, the Europe, North America, which are controlling and colonizing and brutalizing the entire world. And the rest of unpeople who actually have to vote, have to behave, have to do exactly what they are told by the colonialists. And it's the same pattern that is happening all over the world. I was making documentary films in DRC, Congo, in Rwanda, in Kenya, or I lived in Latin America. I see it all. It's the same pattern. So when we talk about democracy, we are talking about the extremely small, selfish, arrogant, and aggressive part of the world, which with the culture that is actually absolutely accepting with the population, with the culture that is accepting this plunder, that is subsidizing its so-called democracy and freedom. But in fact, it's nothing else than a simple colonial plunder.
I would like to stop this conversation because we're not going to get to any kind of agreement, and that's for sure, completely polarized. But what I would like to ask both of you is another question. It seems to be actual fact that we don't fight as many wars as we used to. We don't actually go in there with tanks and guns and bomb people as much as we used to, although we do it a lot. But yet, we do have a lot of revolutions, color revolutions, regime changes, and it seems to be driven by other forces, such as information wars, such as economic sanctions. You're telling me, Dr. Korn, that that's not true.
I don't know of any case of economic sanctions provoking a war. And I'm not sure whether there are somehow more wars at the moment. There was certainly a great deal more control in the era of the Cold War, where you had your great power blocks. And since then, there has been wars about nationalism, independence. There have been wars about religion. Mm-hmm. I don't see any wars about sanctions. And I certainly don't see wars information. You have information that is, I think, affecting the problem, making certain kinds of information. For example, you have the propaganda that comes out of Russia constantly that portraying the Baltic states, the Ukrainians as Nazis. I had to live with this for years. I'm blatant, crude, violent stuff. You have the new history coming out of Russia. That's Putin's new history is information war, glorification of Stalin, repudiation of the 1989 commission that admitted that the takeover of the Baltic states had been an aggressive act, and now Russia's saying it was okay. I mean, the sheer lies that come out of Russia these days, and I've been following this for years, and I'm writing about it now, is a form of conflict, and I would agree. But the main driver of this is certainly not the Western democracies, which really have no clear information campaign at all. I'd like to see one. It's country like Russia, which has a large and well-organized group, people who are trolling, people with phony NGOs, their Russian media, which I watched for 5.5 years, virulent, nasty stuff. Mm-hmm. And this is trying to provoke conflict.
Okay, just let me counter that a little bit, okay, because it can take up too much time to answer every one of your points. There'd be an awful lot of them. Firstly, every time something happens, Russia, I'm aware of the messages from the West, for example, the Brexit situation. And there's all sorts of accusations that Russia was involved in Brexit, somehow encouraging Britain to leave the EU. It's absolute rubbish. Every time something happens, Russia is accused. And what is incredible, people seem to confuse Putin in Russia. It's Putin's Russia, it's Putin's army, it's Putin's that. Well, Putin, it's not Putin, it's Russians' army.
I'd agree.
Russians' feelings, Russian opinion. I mean, this sort of basic misconceptions of even territorially, what is Russia? Russia isn't the countries in the Soviet Union. There's all sorts of basic, even the BBC makes them almost every day. So we are also getting a lot of stuff. It's not just one way. Andre.
Look, I just spent 2 weeks in Russian Far East, in Vladivostok, Khabarovsk, and Kamchatka. And I just went there exactly for this purpose, because I wanted to see how is this part of the world in the country which is being constantly demonized by the West. I saw extremely impressive nation with new universities, great cultural centers, infrastructure, roads, new airports, everything. I mean, Russia is growing. It's a very vibrant country. It's a country which is being demonized by the West. Totally, and for one simple reason, which we didn't mention during this program, because the West cannot tolerate any opposition. It is this pathological, as psychiatrist Jung used to call, pathological obsession with controlling. And you have countries like China, like Russia, and some Latin American countries and other few places that they cannot control, and the West will do everything to destroy them, because they don't fall into the orbit because they are too strong, too sophisticated to just fall on the knees and accept the dictate.
Okay, well, look, sorry, listeners, you've listened to some of the arguments that are behind the informational war that's going on now, and I guess you probably can see how much of what we hear is actually not really based on proper analysis. And I'm really grateful for my two guests for saying actually what you think, you know, and putting you on the line. And you listeners, you know, you can make up your own mind. That's what it's all about. I'm just here to sort of be the referee in a little way. So thank you very much indeed, Andrzej Wieczek, geopolitical analyst, novelist, filmmaker, investigative journalist. And thank you very much indeed, Dr. James Corum, an American air power historian and scholar of counterinsurgency. And thank you again, listeners. Goodbye.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.